And thank you, everyone. Welcome to When Pigs Fly. And I want to thank BBS Radio, of course, for producing my show. Of course, this is Andrew Federer. And again, thank you for all listening. A lot of things, I guess, are happening around the world. And unfortunately, those who are taken out of the news and not heard about what's happening in Syria, my hearts and my thoughts go out to those who are suffering in Syria at the present. Of course, in all areas, in all places, including those who have suffered due to the Sandy hurricane that still have issues right now. And of course, those people are living on the in Staten Island or have lived on Staten Island. Anyway, I hope you get your lives back in order, things of such. Now, one thing I've thought of and never really got into aspects of and I always talk about is energy. I know some people have spiritual energy and this energy and all that stuff, which is energy, of course. But I wanted to get into a thing, understanding of politics of energy. And I thought that was pretty important to understand because then people can understand how it has intrinsically involved all politics, and specifically, for example, in our politics in the Middle East, worldwide, our economics, everything's associated with it. And where's energy in our society, if you look at it? Energy has its foundations being a fundamental role in shaping humans, the condition. I mean, people's need for energy is essentially its survival in its basic form. So it's not surprising that energy production and consumption are some of the most important activities in human life. I mean, it has been argued that energy is literally the key to the advancement of civilization, and that the evolution of societies is dependent on the conversion of this energy for human use. Now, there have been several who have questioned the long-held assumption that the standard of living and the quality of civilizations are proportional to the quantity of energy a society uses. However, I would concur in precise, it may be most people still accept the steadfast formula, which often said, energy equals progress, which equals civilization. There's been a widespread belief that energy and civilization are intrinsically linked, certainly having its historical foundation, which I just mentioned. I mean, it really does. I mean, since the day dawn of history, those who believe in Adam and Eve, even humans have focused on controlling the stores of energy and the flows of that in part within nature. I mean, from the very get-go, people have relied solely on the chemical caloric energy gained from food. Obvious. It produces the energy and the kinetic energy or mechanical energy of our working muscles, right? Of course, this also has to do with animals, which we had in the past and still do utilize animals. The little oxen, the horse and buggy. People are able to unlock other outcomes of physical limits imposed on their own muscles by using tools and harnessing energies outside their bodies. The earliest energy tools were those, of course, used to hunt animals. And then, of course, harvest plants, catch fish, fowl, and of course, processing and shipping these foodstuffs. In fact, most family structures of societal groupings and political and economic institutions created over thousands and thousands and thousands of years primarily focus on the extraction and processing, exchange, and marketing of food, as well as fossil and organic energies, wood, peat, coal. And they've utilized these for heating, cooking, lighting, firing the kilns, the furnaces, and used in smelting ores. The vast array unique human cultures absorb the quest for these basic energy resources into the widest range of human activities. I mean, even in spiritual rituals, think about it, there's always energy use. Festivals, taboos, myth, dance, games, religion, language, archer, all which embody humans' cultural values in the fundamental forms. Really, quite simply, human existence has been dominated by this necessity of energy. It's fascinating, though, that energy is not often spoken of. But we look back in the time spans, they call sometimes called the age of differentials of utilizing methods of changes of energy and kinds of energy. One would be, let's say, the age of water power. Before the modern era, people relied for power on their own muscles or on domestic muscles of the muscles of domestic animals, such as horses, oxen. And then there was on water and wind. People use energy resources to create a variety of significant landscapes, from agricultural fields and grazing land to mining centers and commercial woodlots. I mean, they literally built cities, transportation networks of ancient civilizations. The technologies of these relied on primarily the energy resources, which we're all too familiar with: axes, picks, plows, harnesses, wagons, carriages, water wheels, windmills, sail ships. I mean, Europe in its own possessed many of these water potentially carrying, benefiting, harnessing, energy producing, moving water systems. I mean, the vertical water wheel invented perhaps over 200 years BCE was spread all across Europe and utilized over and over and over again. I mean, Rome used water wheels to power mills, to crush grain, create cloth, tan, leather, smelt, shape iron, saw wood, carry out a variety of industrial processes. I mean, the productivity increase and dependence on human and animal muscle power began to decline in locations with good water power resources. Hence why it was so important to create cities, civilizations near waterways. Water grew to be a central element in Western technology. I mean, literally during the Middle Ages, hydraulic engineers mounted mills on boats and bridges. And then, of course, became the hydropower of dams to store and develop water pastures, to have water, divert water to power canals. By the 15th century, France alone had a massive complex of these mills. In reality, industrial dependence on water power. The development of the crankshaft, and the crankshaft allowing the water power to apply to these tasks, it required reciprocating motion, operating trips and hammers and blast furnaces started being utilized even more so, which then revolutionized the iron industry. I mean, the water mills in Europe increased steadily and steadily, larger and larger, and then there was more powerful water-powered industrial complex then began to emerge. This carried on even to cotton mills. I mean, meanwhile, the harnessing of wind power then started became the ultimate behind sailing ships, which drove the commerce. That happened from days of who knows how far back when, right? Always been wind power. I mean, wind power then was brought into, even when there was water power, windmills. You all see the windmills in Holland. By the 1800s, citizens even on the newly established United States of America were importing English-style textile factories. Within 2 decades, they expanded water-powered industrial cities in Massachusetts and other New England locations. By the time the Industrial Revolution occurred, Euro-American industry became so dependent on energy, but it was entirely on water power. And then the emergence of steam. The modern era began with a new power, a new energy source. And it was introduced to also to coal. So between the steam engines and those of James Watt's created, the interrelations between coal mining and the iron industry and steam power led to the advance of steam technology. By the 1800s, steam engines joined forces with water wheels and powering English mills, and of course, within the United States. Entrepreneurs found the steam power eventually over coming water power geographic inflexibility. Therefore, you can have a factory anywhere, not necessarily near a waterway. The limitation that was once limited, steam could only support so many mills. The water wheel stoppages, the slow drowns caused by drought, the flooding, ice, the limitations on the water power system continue be the dominant energy source, though steam power was progressing more and more and more. And we all know about the railroads. During the 18th century, steam engines improved enormously. I mean, American business imported the steam power in the 1840s, and it became its sustenance. Then there was the Philadelphia inventor Olive Evans. Family's known for automating water power flour, patented one of the first successful high-pressure steam engines. His engine and others modeled on it soon drove the riverboats and the railroads that characterized America's 19th century transportation revolution. In 1876, in Philadelphia, enormous iconic Corliss steam engine towered over the main exhibition hall and powered the hundreds of machines on display at the Centennial Exhibition. The steam engine permanently established a link between fossil energy resources and industrialization. England and European countries turned to coal for steam fuel even before the 1800s. But by the mid-19th century, the coal industry in the Appalachians was only succeeded by wood in the northern and west in the United States. On the Pacific coast, manufacturers and transport continued to use wood, but they preferred coal and even imported great costs from far away as Australia. The scarcity and high cost of good coal on the Pacific coast, combined with discoveries of petroleum, though, in the Southern California areas, resulted in the development of oil as steam fuel. That's when it started. This is when oil became the new fuel. Of course, we had the electric age that started slowly progressing in. Among the technologies challenging the using of inanimate energy resources is the transmission of power. Toward the 18th century, the fascination with the phenomenon of electricity captured many. the production of electricity with primary batteries and eventually with electromagnetic induction, the transmission of electricity through copper wires, and the development of electric motors ultimately revolutionized the transmission of power. By the end of the 19th century, restrictive and inflexible direct connection of manufacturing machines to water wheels, to windmills, to steam engines by gears, drive sets, belts, gave way to electrically powered machinery, getting its power through wires strung far away from hydroelectric and steam turbine power plants. The shape and character factories have changed dramatically during the 20th century, as machines powered by electric motors could be seated upon anywhere. Additionally, electric power supplanted horsepower or horse drawn and even steam-powered street railways with electric trolleys. It began to replace gas for outdoor lighting, and it replaced kerosene lights and wood and coal stoves and heaters in homes. Thomas Edison was especially important in this development of electricity. As noted in a Franklin Institute case study, Edison's innovative approach to invention propelled the development of electric light plus the generation of distribution system to make it work. In the 1880s, his lamp, his incandescent lamp, made possible widespread, reliable commercial indoor lighting, and his Pearl Street Central Station generating system in the Manhattan became an archetype for electric power generation and distribution. Equally significant, Edison mentored a number of other important contributors to electric technology, among them Frank Prague, who constructed the first commercially successful electric street rail system in Richmond, Virginia in 1887. And there is, of course, who else but Nikola Tesla, who eventually developed alternating current power. We'll get more on Tesla. Edison's direct current power system became the initial standard for distribution of electricity, powering electrical railroads, manufacturing motors, as well as light. Unfortunately, it could not be easily transmitted over long distances. While Tesla's AC power could. Implemented by Edison's competitor in electric power, the Westinghouse Company, AC power superseded direct power, or direct current power. It made possible the development of large electrical generating plants, sited in long distances from their customers. The famous one, of course, was Westinghouse Hydropower at Niagara Falls, with Tesla polyphase system, which is perhaps better known and developed in AC power, transferred power system from even a distance of Sierra Nevada power sites in California to the coast cities of San Francisco and Los Angeles, establishing the standard in long-distance polyphase electrical power system. By the early 20th century, electricity had become the favored method for transmitting energy. But by applying it for human uses, depended on many scientists and technicians working together. Perhaps Edison's most important invention was the Industrial Research Laboratory. By the beginning of the 20th century, General Electric Research Laboratory had emerged as a model for advancing technology. General Electric, that even exists today, GE. Their researchers steadily improved ways in which humankind could apply electricity. Among them was William Coolidge stood. In fact, he developed the tungsten filament for Edison's incandescent light. And later, of course, the X-ray tube, which earned him a most respected place in the ranks of scientists and engineers. And of course, at the turn of the century, as electricity became more used, a thing called nuclear age started expanding and coming into fruition. The exploitation of energy resources increased, though, and the hydroelectricity continued to play an important role in the modern energy matrix. And accessible water processes were soon to be tapped. Engineers steadily improved steam turbine technology so that more electricity could be generated from even smaller quantities of fuel. As the size and efficiency of power plants increased, the cost of electric power dropped dramatically, which stimulated even more consumption of electricity. Fossil fuels, first coal, then oil, became the essential energy for electric power. Unfortunately, during the 1960s, increasing efficiency in electric power generation leveled off. The cost of electricity began to climb. Moreover, a growing economic and environmental movement attributed acid rain and other negative effects to the heavy use of fossil fuels, coal, and more important, oil. As the research continued for an alternative approach from fossil fuel electrical power generation, led to many to utilizing atomic power, in other words, nuclear power. I mean, this goes back since the time in research in physics that led to the discovery of nuclear radiation, and the most discovery of that was, of course, Marie Curie, whose work on the spontaneous radiation emitted by uranium compounds set the stage for subsequent discoveries and the intrinsic power of the atom. The early decades of the 20th century brought sustained scientific research in atomic physics, particularly in Europe, and the Italian physics Fermi at the University of Rome, where he was prominent amongst many scientists working in this field during the 1930s. He focused on producing artificial radiation by bombarding uranium atoms with neutrons. As the European world began to grow more and more unstable, and the rise, of course, of Nazi Germany, its alliance with its Italian fascists, increasing Jew hatred, anti-Semitism, Fermi and other physicists began leaving their universities and research to America, North America. Fermi's particular research was quite remarkable, for he was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1938 and received permission from Italy's fascist government to go to Stockholm to receive the award. Instead of returning to Italy, he and his Jewish wife and Jewish children traveled to the United States, where Fermi took a professorship in Columbia University. As the world went into war in the 1940s, Fermi and other physicists, such as famous Albert Einstein, came to the United States, and they came to understand that uranium split by a neutron would cause a self-perpetuating chain reaction of atomic splitting or atom splitting that would release enormous energy. This process is called nuclear fission. And it was suggested possible for military applications. And Fermi and his colleagues at Columbia was also joined for the famous Albert Einstein to persuade the United States government to study the idea. Meanwhile, at Columbia, Fermi sought to develop a controlled nuclear fission chain. In 1942, that's when Franklin Roosevelt authorized the Manhattan Project. Fermi was relocated to the University of Chicago, In December of that year, him and his team had controlled the first nuclear reaction. The work of Fermi and other nuclear physicists, of course, led to the development of the atom. And unfortunately, it was used twice against Japan in 1945. In the wake of World War II, the United States created the Atomic Energy Commission to oversee nuclear weapons as well as development, and to bring nuclear power to peaceful applications as well. During the 1950s, the AAEC worked with public utilities such as Pacific Gas and Electric Company in California to develop electric power using nuclear fission. And nuclear energy soon emerged as one of the most touted solutions to electrical world's energy. Industrialized nations everywhere began constructing these plants to develop the ever demanding demands for electrical power. But nuclear power was not without its drawbacks. By the end of the 1970s, seismic data became substantial enough issue for the California that a moratorium was placed on the building on any new power plants. In 1973, and I remember this so specifically, there was the famous Three Mile Island incident, which the accident occurred in, of course, it was in Pennsylvania, which galvanized nuclear power opponents. These incidents combined with other unresolved resolutions, in particular, what the hell do you do with the nuclear waste? Extended construction times to efficiently produce nuclear power became limited. In 1986, the meltdown at Chernobyl nuclear power plant in Ukraine became subsequent and poisoning. But Italy, Germany, and other countries still continued on their pathway on relying on nuclear power. While nuclear energy has not gone away, it is still seen by many as one of the best solutions to human energies. Of course, there's other ones, other alternative resources that they haven't even touched that we're now just addressing and utilizing. One, of course, is solar, another wind, another biomass. No matter where people find the energy to support their culture and society, it is plain that the human life has been dominated by the age-old necessity. That is energy. Energy. Energy case studies presented by here have been unique in truly underscoring humankind's scientific and technological quest to harness inanimate energy for its use. Imagine, if you can, just what would the next steps be in our energy and history be? That is the politics of energy. Looking past the lifetime of our generations from civilizations to civilizations, we've even used energy in the most malicious place. The most malicious, of course, slavery as its energy. We use people as our slaves as energy. From Africa to the Hebrews in Egypt, the slaves in Asia, Middle East, even in Europe, Africa, slavery. Rome in itself was built upon slavery. It lived on slavery. Its population was like 60 to 70% slaves. Without slavery, there would have been no Rome. Which reminds me of Spartacus' revolt. Why it was so imperative to squash it. Slavery had its essences of where it went to with the Americas. Without what happened with slavery, African Americans would not have been in the United States. Why? Because Americans use that vicious form of energy. They even tried utilizing Native Americans. And what did they do to the Native Americans? And what is today's energy use? We have cars that produce, engines, a piston thing, right? Or diesel. But most of the oil, a lot of, has been producing electricity. Electricity is probably the most component thing that we utilize every single thing. Our cars. I mean, look at everything we have today. A computer that I'm on right now. The lights in our houses. Our heating. The machinery. Everything you can think of. Electricity. And what's generating that electricity? That thing that Tesla developed. the turbines producing the AC. Of course, in Europe, they use DC. Not exactly the most efficient, but it's easy for them to produce. Today, though, we have oil, black crude, as they would say. Today, oil has been the assumed foundation of energy since the 1800s. I mean, think about it. It was in the 1800s, the turnabout of the Industrial Revolution, the rise of the Morgans, the Rockefellers, and so on. Energy is what also fuels wars. Since the days of civil war, think about it. Energy use of slaves was slavery. The use of energy. Everything's always been about energy. Since World War I, it's been king. The control of oil has been paramount. People think the politics in the Middle East is Israel and Arabs. No, it's oil. Amongst United States, amongst the Europe, amongst the Brits, amongst Russia, China, always been oil, where the oil is. People don't get it that even in the United States, its policy is based upon oil. Look at history from the very get-go. In World War I, when the things change controls the world, what happened? Oil. When the Brits took over what was once Ottoman power territory along with the French, what happened? Think about what happened during that time. There was a king called King Hejaz, who was king of Arabia, who strategically helped the British fight against the Ottomans. He helped Allenby strategically whipping the Ottomans out of that area. In fact, it was famously done with the King Hejaz sent his son Amir Faisal, who signed in 1909 an agreement with the Jews to create the Jewish state. And in Corso, acknowledging that all of Arabia, there were regions. And he was king of Arabia. It was not Saudi, it was Hejaz, who was a Hashemite. The Hashemites controlled Arabia, not the Saudis. So, what happened to King Hejaz? If you want to know what oil and everything that happened in the Middle East, learn, read about what happened to the demise of King Hejaz. In the 1920s, the Saudis were helped by both the Brits and the US for control of the oil, but more so by the Brits. The Brits strategically helped the Saudis take control through a Arab revolt, call it, put that in quotes. Coup d'etat, as they say, to take over that area. And hence, who controlled the oil? Saudi family then took control of Arabia, and where was the oil? Who had control of it? British Petroleum Products, BP. Boy, does that name sound familiar. Think about it. Oil. So, what did the Brits do? He got out Hejaz out of there, tearing up the agreement that he had done with the Jews in 1919, and then formed what they call the San Remo Conference. And during the San Remo Conference, they decided to divide up how they would just slice up and dice up the Ottoman Empire. In that agreement, of course, they gave the Jews their land, but then doing so, they gave, to make it sound nice, they gave Syria, or the Syrian Mandate, to France, which became an enclave of Lebanon because the enclave of Lebanon was mainly Christian, similar to what they did when they sliced up later on, some years later, with the then two Pakistans and India, between Muslim and Hindi areas. But why did they do this? There were strategic reasons why. There was no such thing as Iraq before 1919. Not Syria, not Lebanon, not Israel, not Jordan. The very reason they created Iraq was for oil. In Kirkuk, which is the northern part of Iraq, there's huge quantities of oil. Probably one of the oldest refineries. I mean, productions of oil. And what they do is start pumping that oil. So now where do they ship it? They had a railroad line that ran straight through Syria. Who controlled Syria? The French. And that course, the railroad ran right through where? Into Israel. And who controlled Israel at the time under the Palestine Mandate? The Brits. And there's these huge refineries. I think they're still there, of course. In Haifa. So the Brits had a cool little thing going. Think about it. And what they gave the promise for the Jews for that part of Palestine Mandate was for one simple reason. They get their foot in the door. And then they brought in the 1920s El Hussein to start the divide and conquer, because if the Jews had their own country, they'd lose refineries, right? It's all about energy, oil, control. Nice little thing, huh? I mean, think about it. What was there before 1919? And of course, Jordan, if you ask anybody what the hell Jordan is, they'll give you cross-eyed answers. I constantly ask people, what is Jordan or what is Jordanian? They can't even answer you. Jordan sits on about 70% of the Palestine Mandate. What is Jordan, for those who don't know? Jordan was a part of the Palestine Mandate. It has, so essentially Arabs, if people want to call themselves Palestinian, you'd say 70-80%. The other 20% you could say are Bedouin. Yeah, Bedouins originally from Jordan, or that area, that mandated area. And the king in the ruling faction is Hashemite, or what are Hashemites? That was from King Hejaz. They were a Hashemite family. That was the Hashemites. Now, King Hejaz had two sons. And, of course, one was Abdullah and one was Faisal. Of course, Faisal was the emir who signed the 1919 paper in behalf of Hejaz, creating the Jewish homeland, or emphasized that would be the homeland. Of course, that included part, by the way, just east of the Jordan River. And the rest was going to be Arabia, and they had like little regions. Anyway, Jordan was then called Transjordan, given to Sheikh Abdullah, or King Abdullah later, who was a son of Hejaz. And this is after the demise of Hejaz. It was sort of like, here, we'll give you this because we did this to your dad. And it was also to control King Abdullah, because whose British army supported King Abdullah in that area and trained them? Later on, created the Arab Legion of Jordan. In Iraq, of course, originally they had Faisal, who was he was put into Syria, and the Brits had total control of Iraq, but they started having problems with Iraq. So in Iraq, Faisal was sort of kicked out of an Arab revolt against him in Syria, and the French were having problems at that time. And then they put Faisal into Iraq, and he became the king of Iraq, and hence officially created Iraq. History. And under those two puppet states, if you can call them that, the British controlled everything. There was no such thing as Iraq. That's why today people, when they go, what's Iraq? It really is three regions. And of course, you know who they screw. They screw the Kurds. Kurds have a country, have their own language, but you don't see them on the UN yesterday. You don't have, see any people. I guess they need to have suicide bombs and shoot rockets in order to get their country. They have their own language, own people. They've been for thousands of years. They're not a made-up entity like the Palestinians. But they don't have their country, right? Now, they're in the north. They're a part of Kirkuk, and that's why they never got it. Their own country. Kirkuk is part of Kurdistan. And then, of course, you have the Shiites and Sunnis. So essentially, they brought in three peoples and carved it around a circle and go, we're calling that Iraq. Therefore, it became Iraq. There's no such thing as Iraqis either. That's why you have a problem in today. This is what George Bush Jr. didn't understand. That when he went in Iraq, it was like put together like Yugoslavia. Hussein kept it intact. Once he was gone, kaboom. Just like what happened with Tito was gone, Yugoslavia went to hell and it broke up. But what was the base of it? Oil. Everything is about oil. And of course, the Soviet Union. I mean, since World War II, what was the U.S. and Japanese and Germans basically essentially fighting over? What was the chessboard game? Oil. I mean, Germany took over Europe, but when they went into North Africa, oil, Libya, oil. It's always been oil. The Soviets, they have oil themselves up in Russia, the Soviet Union. Everybody forgets about the Soviet Union. It's like as if they never existed. Helped create what even now even people forget about the politics. It was the Soviet Union who created the PLO, not even the Arabs. It was their idea. It was their idea even to create a Palestinian entity because they realized it'd be a thumb. They had problems because Israelis were at the time allied with the Brits. It was a game of politics and puppets. It had nothing to do, and it was all about one thing. Strategically controlling oil. The Suez Canal was a distribution lane for oil. That's why that was so important. 1956. Remember that. I mean, today's policies and Middle East are all basically Saudi policy. People keep on saying, APAC or the Israelis influence is the U.S. policy. No, it's Saudi policy. What the Saudis say is what goes on. People don't realize the Saudis may be allied or like the certain things that want Israel. But it's bottom line, it's Saudi policy. Always has been. Go look at what Aramco is. The American integrated oil company, which works with the Saudis. They protect the Saudis. They held up the Saudis. It became that way since World War II. But the first link was the Brits. The Brits, the British, and the Americans are so interwoven, it's unreal when it comes to energy. They're like brothers. Two gangs who got together and said, okay, we're going to control all energy and all oil. They did. Think about what happened in Iran. In the 1950s, the Iranians had a democratic country. They got rid of the Shah in the 50s. They had a democratic country, and then they decided to nationalize and create their own oil company, control its oil, which excluded who? British Petroleum, and they lost control. So what did the Brits do? They requested, and this is on documents, requested the U.S. to intervene, and like a good brother, they did. The CIA brought in the Shah into Iran again. Took back power and therefore maintained the oil control out of Iran. What was the relationship even with the U.S. and Hussein? People remember Saddam Hussein was created by who? Who? The U.S. Hussein came into power against the then power. I forget his name, the general who they were controlled by the Soviets. Flipped puppets. who's on whose side. It was all about controlling oil. They used them, spit them out. Gaddafi, who was he backed by? The Soviet Union. It's whose team you're on. I mean, people don't realize when Israel was born in 1948, it was allied by the Soviets because the British didn't like them. In fact, they had one of their leading commanders who ran the armies of the Arab nations against Israel to wipe it out. It was the Brits who wanted to wipe out Israel. That is a historical fact. In fact, their officer, Gibbs, they actually knighted him for that action, or tried to. He created the Arab Legion. In 1950s, though, what happened? It switched. Nasser took control of Egypt, and he's part of the Muslim Brotherhood. And when he took over Egypt, he was allied by who? The Soviet Union. He then took control of the Suez, even though on our prior agreements that Suez belonged to the British. By closing down the Suez and having control, he limited oil going through there. Thus, war. But anyway, going back, and I'll explain that again later in a sec. I got off tangent here, because I got a whole bunch of other stuff going. The CIA, anyway, getting back to this historical development, brought in the Shah. And of course, we know in the 70s, Shah refused to increase oil production, which then, of course, led to the energy crisis, which then President Carter brought him down and brought in Khomeini and sort of actually boomeranged in, of course, Carter's face. And like I said, from 1947 till 56, UK was Israel's arch enemy. But when Nasser controlled Egypt with the Soviet backing, and then he nationalized the Suez Canal, the transfer of oil by British petroleum power was majorly a fuck up. So UK allied itself with Israel, during which did like basically a 180 in its policy toward Israel. In 1956, there was a war which was opened up for the Suez, which included Israel. Now, you got to realize that at that time, there was a Fedayeen-led group, Yasser Arafat, who was a commander in the Egyptian army, who later then led a Fedayeen terrorist attack against Israeli civilians in the 50s. This, amongst the Suez closure, also gave Israel incentive to attack in 1956. Israel won the Sinai, but then was under pressure by the Eisenhowers with a promise of access to the Suez Canal, which never happened. Pulled back from the Sinai. Again, there is reason why we're in the Middle East. Iraq was about oil, nothing about oil. China needs oil. The U.S. needs it. The growing world economy needs it, or they think they do. Well, they all think they need it. Why do you think the EU needs oil? And why was the oil embargo in the 19th, which created the new EU policy, the new European policy amongst them? Why do you think they lean in Europe toward Arab states? Oil. The lean toward Arabism, including the Palestinian issues in Europe, has always been oil since the 70s. Money talks, bullshit walks. Oil makes countries walk. Today, though, there's a new politics that have emerged. A new birth of oil, a new birth of energy. In fact, U.S. is said to be the largest reserve of natural gas with oil shale. In fact, it's going to become larger than even Saudi Arabia. In 20 years' time or less, the U.S. will be totally independent of import energy. Israel itself will be a major development of its own natural gas reserves, making it totally independent. Oil, gas, changing the dynamics of policies in the enemy. This is what's happening in the Middle East, the demise of Arab power. In the next 20 years, there is a major political transition that's about to unfold. And besides that, there's another forms of energy starting to be utilized. Solar, wind, geothermal, electric power. I mean, we do have other alternatives to use, which I'll get into. The changing dynamics of make us really civilized, what we're supposed to be doing, which we've always had. There is, in fact, a thing called the John Searle effect generator. Now, John Searle, who in 1946 developed his, called the John Searle effect generator, which effectively captures kinetic energy generated by natural changes in the ambient temperature and uses it in creating electricity. The technology works based upon a precise design that utilizes the unique characteristics of materials to create a continual motion. These materials include magnets, neodymium, Teflon, and copper. When joined together in just the right way, these materials are captured or perpetuating a cycle of electronic movement that is virtually infinite, which gives the device the potential to create more power than it uses to power itself. In other words, its success, if it is successful, the SEG could one day replace our dependence on fossils altogether. So, how does this work? The SEGI, like I said, is composed of a series of circular cylinders, all which have small magnetic motors spaced evenly throughout them. The circular patterns allows the rotors to have a continuous movement around cylinders, and their spacing design prevents any mechanical wear or friction. That's how they use, and it does work. Please Google John Searle generator and check it out yourself. S-E-A-R-L effect, and you'll find it. Look it up YouTube. See how it works. It does work. It's not bullshit. And of course, there's another famous system. I mentioned earlier a guy named Nikola Tesla. We have, unfortunately, we have AC, but people forget we have a lot of things because of him. There's fluorescent light bulbs. I mean, there's multiple two things we have. Even the internet that we have today is because of him. His ideas and understandings of things, of how our world really works. Now, free energy suppression is not just, and this gets into politics of it, who controls the energy. Like I just showed you, the dynamic wars and control of Middle Eastern politics, world politics, because of energy. And why the suppression of free energy? It's not just, it's not about just politically, it's more control of not just economic, it is literally the control. There is a conspiracy, not a conspiracy, but a reality. Free energy suppression is not a conspiracy. It is reality. Claiming that some certain special in-groups are suppressing, in fact, has been happening. It's a fact, and have suppressed it in past, present. Technologies that could have provided us energy at reduced cost or even reduced altogether, reduced pollution output, or could even reduce the energy consumption of various devices. These groups most often implicated in such activity are the oil industry, petroleum, national governments, monetary system, automakers. The most common perceived motive is preservation of the economic status quo and sustained increase of fuel prices. Dependent upon the expansive energy is perpetuated by governments in order to control the populace on means of hydraulic despotism. In other words, we are controlled by the energy. That's what the biggest fear. If we had free energy, it would change everything. The principal belief is that electric companies, gas, heating, oil companies would lose half or more of their profits with free energy available. Therefore, these companies would going millions upon billions bribing, get away with whatever they want. British Petroleum, what did they do in the Gulf? purposely doing that, making billions, if you or me cause the death of somebody, we'd be put in jail. They cause thousands to be dying, and look what they did. Not one went to jail. Aren't they criminals? They caused more in the Gulf of deaths than Assad did in the 3 years of all the killing of the civilians. But what happened to BP? Look what they've done. They even attacked our Earth, screwing up, and they did it on purpose. This is a fact. And we will mention Halliburton being involved in it too. We know all the connections there. Politics, profits. See, their tactic and means of expression include buying the patent, free energy. There's been devices over and over, continually trying to control things. Buying devices, controlling. I mean, I remember I was in UC Davis when this happened. In the 1970s, in Livermore, they discovered a battery that would never go dead. Because it was developed in Livermore, which is part of Berkeley, which is a public entity, they had to put it up for auction. Who bought it? General Electric. Never heard about it again. I was in UC Davis when they discovered a plant that was a morph between of a semi kind of succulent plant that had petroleum product. It literally produced like petroleum gas kind of thing, even though I know it would be carbon-based or whatever. Probably produce pollutants or whatever. But it was during the 70s and that was could have grown all over the United States. It's just basically a cactus. I remember Roslyn Carter flew out to UC Davis, all happy, da-da. They put it up for auction. Guess who bought it? Of course, Standard Oil, Chevron. Did you hear anything about it? No, disappeared. See, they all buy them out. The traditional economic system contains three aspects: capital, goods, and services. Within the aspects of these capital are three substantial components: currency, credit, natural capital. Natural capital comprises of raw material and energy. This differs consistently. And it's the problem. This differs considerably from the orthodox definition of capital in economics. You can see by just the dynamics what happened with Westinghouse and what happened with Tesla. And hopefully Tesla will carry his voice and spirit to free energy. You see, Tesla had created a thing called a magnifying transmitter. Tesla came to a worldwide industrial application of a new radiant energy dream, which was the construction of his huge magnifying transmitter at Shoreham, Long Island, a site which he later named Wardenclyffe. From his return to New York City from Colorado Springs in 1899, Tesla was jubilant, full of enthusiasm for implementing his plan for the commercial application of radiant energy. He turned to J.P. Morgan with a substantial portion for funding to finance the huge project at Wardenclyffe. Morgan was chiefly concerned with turning a profit from this overseas radio transmissions, since Marconi was in fact locking up the market. But Morgan, even aggressor, wanted a share of the market. When Tesla told him that the transfer could transmit intelligence to the world, Morgan assumed that he meant ordinary radio communication, but Tesla was not referring to radio transmission. He was talking something bigger. Avoiding revealing altered Morgan or the true face of the project, he just continued it. Some considered late in time later that Tesla eventually felt compelled to tell Morgan the larger possibilities offered by the magnifying transmitter when he needed more funding to do it. Tesla thought that Morgan would be overwhelmed by his expanded explanation of the true capacity and would be anxious to continue the work. But Tesla's assumption had backfired, and Morgan refused to lay out any more money, in fact, shut it down. Sadly, the enormous benefits that what could have been made available to society by Tesla's magnifying transfer project died then and there. Morgan and Westinghouse had orchestrated to the demise of Tesla, forcing to consistently be dependent on him and even creatively making him financially by backing him, controlling him. During the early period, when Tesla himself had made millions from his polyphase AC royalty payment, other earnings, Morgan wooed him. Morgan wanted to woo Tesla with a deal with that effect that gave Morgan majority control over his patents and projects. But Tesla turned them down, telling Morgan that he had enough money of his own to fund his own part. Returning to his hotel, the very meeting that Morgan, however, had, Tesla was told that his Lowry had been burned down to the ground, which was true. It was represented as a loss to Tesla. It shook him deeply. He was totally devastated. It was arson that was committed by Morgan. In order to save face, Morgan was embarrassed by Tesla for putting up with the money, paying for the rebuilding of a new lab. He called it philanthropy, but he had other demise, other things. This is all facts. Check it out. In fact, we could have had Radiant Energy. If you look at what Radiant Energy, I'm not going to get the dynamics of it. It uses electric charge intent in creating condensed entropy from Earth, which goes in the upper atmosphere and it's transforming electricity current. This is a fact. He was able to produce over 200 billion volts. The Earth, on the other hand, is charged with a negative electricity. This tremendous electrical force between the two bodies constitutes, at least in part, what is called cosmic energy. It varies from night to day and from season to season, but is always present. This is what he's going to utilize. He was able to transfer a distance of 60 miles. There's a large difference of voltage, somewhere around 360,000 volts, which he could utilize. With gases that are misreacting as an insulator between the two opposite stores of electrical charges, the region could be grounded and the edge of space traps creating a great deal of energy. Despite the larger size of the planet, electricity like a capacitor, which keeps positive and negative charges apart. By using the air as a non-conducting material as an insulator, the Earth has a charge of 96,500 coulombs, which is the potential of 360,000 volts. The Earth constitutes a capacitor of 0.25 farads. If you look in a formula for calculating this, energy stored in a capacitor would be E equals 1.5 CV2. That is applied to Earth. These are facts. We have the capability today to produce this. Why isn't it being done? Ask yourself. The Radiant Energy is a self-oscillating capacity system. It is extremely with very little power, keeps things consistently going. We have this ability. 1932, Nikola Tesla stated, "I've harnessed the cosmic rays and caused them to operate a motive device. The attractive features of the cosmic rays is their consistency. They shower over upon us throughout the 24-hour cycles. It will not." But it will require us to develop storing energy devices necessary to develop and hide these devices. He said further, they will move with a velocity extending that of light. The cosmic ray ionizes air, setting free many charges of ions and electrons. These charges are captured in condenser, which is made to charge them throughout the circuit motor. I know this is getting a little intricate. But you can see he had a system. We had free electricity. We have it today. I mean, we have what is called the TH Moral device. Look it up. It basically effectively captures the static electricity from the surrounding air. Moral's oscillating tubes utilizes this high voltage energy to generate an internal secondary cold fusion reaction. And then you stick the antenna up in the air, and the higher, the better. We have this ability. We have radiant energy to convert to electrical power at this moment. We always have had it. We've had that for over 150 years. Now ask yourself, why is it not being utilized? So, yes, we do indeed have the ability to have free energy as Tesla envisioned. The real question comes to why. Why is it not being implemented? Money and power? It's real simple, isn't it? Then I ask you, what if we did have it? What would happen? Food? What did I say would produce food? We need energy to produce our food, energy to produce our clothing, energy to help develop our healthcare, our sciences. Think about everything around you, electricity. What would happen with our economics? If we had free energy to such a capacity, what eventually would happen to our monetary system? Would our monetary system be obsolete? We will no longer be part of a debt monetary system. What will happen to the banks? What will happen to our property, ownership? We will basically change into that Star Trek understanding. Monetary system will no longer exist. What would happen around the world? Will there be wars fighting over electricity, over energy? Were they fighting over atmosphere? No. Will they be fighting over oil? No, because we're not need oil. For those who believe, which is another thing, the bullshit, is global warming or climate change due to our carbon, they'd be taken care of too. It would change both our economics, our monetary system, and of course, most important, our Mother Earth. Societies would change. Remember, our civilization equates to our energy. Well, if you have free energy, isn't that a free civilization? Think about it. Just think. We do have the ability to have free energy. Educate yourself on it. Talk to other people about it. Not just talk, implement it. Put pressure on talking and getting it put in effect. I know there will be people afraid of it, especially those in power. The ones who are afraid of it are those who control the banks, those who control the energy, those who, as George Carlin would say, the true owners, the real owners. Well, they are not the real owners. There are no owners. That's an illusion. We have the ability to create change. And I know I got very detailed in many things, explaining some things historically and stuff. I apologize for any misunderstandings in the communication part by getting too detailed. But just educate yourself and learn the truth about how our energy and what is free energy. Look up Tesla himself, Nikola Tesla. Look up what I just explained to you about all the dynamics of free energy. And you'll see we have it. And I want to thank you all for listening in. I'm going to close with a special song because it's that kind of time of year, since we only have 21 days, as they say. So it's the end of the world, as REM would say. God bless you all. And have a glorious, glorious weekend. Thank you. Until next week.
With the fear. It's the end of the world.